These are the stories that you need to know about today. An attack on Moscow that makes a lot of noise. Western media outlets are giddy. They're celebrating it like you wouldn't believe. But yesterday, when a school bus was hit, they barely even covered it. What's the difference? I'm going to tell you about it. Also, the Iran deal, it's in. And we got the details.
I said to Scott, Scott, why do we keep their money? What the hell are we giving it back to them? You know, if we didn't give it back, nobody would ever invest in the dollar again.
I've had a great relationship with Bibi, but now Bibi has to be more responsible with respect to Lebanon.
Everything about this deal seems bad to me. It all seems bad. It all seems like a setback. It doesn't seem like it meets any of the measures that the president actually put out there of his goals when it came to this conflict.
Spoken like a true neocon. We want more war. We want more war. That's what they're saying. What does this deal mean? Why did Mr. Trump agree? The picture is much, much more clear today than it was yesterday. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for being there with us. I want to show you something real quick. This is a map of Moscow. Moscow came under attack this morning when many Muscovites woke up. They saw that there was smoke in the air. Some of them were close enough to hear the noises. These were drones and, in a couple of cases, missiles that hit parts of Moscow. Although it looks like a lot on this map, the damage was not that bad, considering there were 16 people injured only. No one was killed, but it made a lot of noise. It made a lot of noise and it made a lot of headlines. Case in point, I want to show you something. I did a screen grab before coming out here on the air, and I want to show you that screen grab now. So I just did a Google search, and I said, I put the title of the story just to see what the headlines were that popped up. And this is what popped up. And look at this, right? So BBC, Moscow hit by largest Ukrainian attack since the start of Russia's full-scale war. You almost get a sense they're relishing in it. Like, yes, Russia's under attack, and we can't wait to write this headline and tell people about it. NBC, another one, right? Neocon Central 2. Moscow refinery ablaze as Ukraine launches biggest attack on Russian capital. You notice they're not saying claims, according to, no attribution. They're just saying, oh, yeah, it's happened, and we're going to tell you what happened. Look at The Guardian. Russian oil refinery on fire after barrage of Ukrainian drones strikes Moscow. And, of course, The New York Times. Ukrainian drones hit Moscow refinery in large-scale assault. You get a sense that they're happy celebrating this reportage about the fact that the people of Russia are suffering in these attacks. But now I want to give you a different example. Yesterday, Ukraine also used drones, but in this case, they hit a bus with a boys' soccer team on it that was traveling in Russia from Belarus to Russia, right? Just above Ukraine. I want to show you the headlines on that one, because I did the same thing. I just wrote the story to see what comes up. First of all, no NBC, no New York Times, no BBC, none of that, right? They didn't cover it. I wonder why. And look at the ones who covered it, right? Start with Euronews, right? Part of your screen, upper right, right? Bus with Belarus children hit by a drone in Russia. Moscow claims. Remember, claims in journalism means you think they're lying, so you're going to use the word claims instead of says, right? But you notice when they were happy to report something, they just said it. But when they don't like the report, they use the word claims. Nice little trick there. By the way, this is an attack on a bus with kids on it. 48 people, 28 children. A woman was killed. It's a civilian target. And it was a boys' soccer team on board. But they're not covering it. And if they do cover it, they minimize it. Look at the whatever the hell this is, the TVP world. I've never heard of them. Ukraine denies, look at the headline. Ukraine denies Russian claims of drone strike on bus with children. Instead of saying it happened, they're saying, well, they say it happened, right? Reuters, they're pro-Western and they too hate Russia. Russia accuses Ukraine. Of attacking a bus carrying school children. Here's the bus. Look at the pictures. We've got pictures of this bus. Russia didn't attack the bus. Belarus didn't attack the bus. There it is. It came under attack with 48 people on board and 28 kids. I've seen the pictures of the children wearing their soccer uniforms outside of the bus, which is, you know, amazing to consider if nothing else, but that's the situation. Fact of the matter is, Russia, here's really what's happening in many ways. Russia's winning the war, per se, right, on the battlefield. Ukraine is trying to win the theatrics. And you got to give them credit. They're doing a really good job with the theatrics, you know, with the help of their handlers. They get bombs, they fire them, they make a lot of noise, they get a lot of headlines, smoke, et cetera, et cetera. That has nothing to do with who's winning the war on the battlefront, but it doesn't matter because that's the choice they've made. And for Russia, it's a tough decision right now. Do you join the theatrics? Do you get involved in the show and do something similar? Or do you fight the good fight, right? Do you let your soldiers handle what they're trying to do in these oblasts, right? I mean, Russia so far has not responded to the taunting, and there's been a lot of taunting, even from Mr. Zelensky, the unelected president of Ukraine. But you do get a sense here in Moscow that people are kind of getting angry about this, right? And it's getting harder and harder to do that. Joining us now to talk about this is Murad Gazdiev. He's an award-winning correspondent who I've had the pleasure of working alongside on many occasions. He knows this story only too well, probably as well as anybody, as a matter of fact. Murad, thanks so much for joining us. Maybe we start with that. Maybe we start with what is your sense that the government of Russia and its officials are thinking as they work their way through this situation? And am I right in the way I explained it? One side is going for theatrics and the other side
is going... something you and I discussed, Rick. That isn't how decision-making works in Russia. You know, something terrible happens, an oil refinery hit in Moscow, huge smoke. Headlines, as you mentioned, from every publication that can write. But that isn't going to affect what Vladimir Putin delegates to his generals. He has delegated the strategy of this war isn't going to change because an oil refinery was hit, or 10 oil refineries. There is no emotion in Russian decision-making. Zero emotion. That is what differentiates it from the United States, from the European Union. Many countries in the world, they have a strategy. They're going to follow that strategy, regardless of whether they're setbacks, tragedies, as we've seen in Starobielsk, as you, Rick, saw in Starobielsk. You were there. You saw the ruins. You talked to the locals. You saw the sentiments among the locals. There was no, oh, when is this going to end?
Yeah.
There was, we want blood. We want revenge.
I'm wondering, though, there is a sense here in Moscow, when I talk to people, that they are being frustrated because they smell the smoke, they see the flames, they hear the noises at night, and it gets them a little bit closer to it. And you get a sense that those people reflect their wishes on the government. Does it make a difference? You know the Russian government as well as anybody. Does it affect them?
That to a certain degree, Rick, of course, I had phone calls this morning. So the drones that attacked Moscow, many of them flew 30, 40 meters above us last night. My cameraman was standing on the balcony with his phone out, with his camera out, and a drone impacted about 80 meters away from him, a building under construction, a high-rise building under construction. I mean, the drones, they hit here first, and then they reached Moscow. The people here, they're long calling for their sake. Why are we waiting? Why? We have the weapons, we have the means to bring, put on the hurt on Kiev. We know where senior Ukrainian administration officials are. We know where their whole leadership is, where their generals are. Why aren't we getting to work? Why aren't we destroying them? Now, there are certain arguments against it. I mean, the United States just destroyed, you know, the entire Iranian leadership. Did that help them? No, it didn't. Of course, the people are much more emotional. You know, you're going to work, you're taking the kids to kindergarten, and there's huge plumes of fire, fireballs, or drones flying overhead. Of course, you want to hit back.
What about the...
War isn't heroism. War is mathematics. It is statistics. And that is what the Russian government does well. Sorry, Rick.
No. I interrupted you. You didn't interrupt me. And what you have to say here is much more valuable than what I have to say, because this is a story you've owned for so long. Here's what else I'm wondering, though, about, Murad. And it's the effect that I also see in the minds of Russians that I haven't seen in the past, where they're not just angry at Ukraine anymore. Their anger has shifted toward the West, and in particular, toward countries like Europe and Germany and France. Like, my golf buddies hate those people. And they recognize that they're the ones who are actually attacking the apartment buildings in Moscow. Does that make a difference?
Yeah, you hit the spot. Because this war, as I've seen it, it's had socially for Russia, it has had phases. So in the first phase, 2022, there were many people, especially, you know, the rich, the well-to-do, the people who enjoyed having villas in Europe, in Florida, in California, you know, global trotters, people who've enjoyed globalism. And they didn't understand why American bases in Ukraine is a bad thing. Now, the United States did a lot to convince Russians that, you know, having American bases or NATO bases on Russia's borders is a bad idea. Venezuela, Iran. So that there was that phase, the initial phase. The second phase, and the Russian government worked very hard for this. The second phase was from 2023 up to about 2025, when the Russian public had no idea that there was a war going on. And you and I, we talked about this as well. You know, the Russian government did everything possible to make sure that the economy ran, people could take vacations, they'd go to Europe, they'd go to Asia, everywhere else, beaches in Egypt and Turkey, flooded with Russian tourists, business flourishing. And now we've entered another phase where, and I believe this is a very stupid decision on the part of Zelensky, on the part especially of the European Union, which after 20 sanctions packages, has been unable to turn Russian civilians against the Russian government. So what they've decided to do, Zelensky and the Europeans, who are, of course, paying and supplying all these drones to Europe, is to bring war to the Russian people, to make sure that Moscow's burning. I mean, what was the objective? What was the plan? Did they really think that setting a refinery on fire or hitting apartment buildings in Moscow would turn the civilians, the Russian people against the Russian leadership?
No.
I mean, the idea itself is ridiculous. It is, isn't it, Rick?
It's making them more anti-Europe. I mean, it's making them hate the UK. It's making them hate the Germany in ways they haven't. I don't see the hate for the United States at the moment, but I do see an anger, a visceral anger against the European capitals, because they do sense that's where the guidance comes from, that's where the money comes from, and that's where the weapons come from, Murad.
Precisely. All Putin has to do is show them the video of drones flying towards Moscow and say, every single one of those was paid for and manufactured, the details, the parts supplied from the European Union, not the United States, not anyone else. It was the European Union. Every single drone operator targeting or guiding, flying these drones, is being paid for. His salary is being paid by the Europeans. So all of this that's happening in Moscow, in other cities here, in Donetsk, ultimately, it wouldn't be happening if the Ukrainians were left alone. They'd have no means to send these drones. For now, it is a lifestyle for Ukrainians. There's very few jobs in Ukraine. There's very few jobs. The military is, it's a stable source of income. For the European Union has essentially turned war into a career. And the only job that many people in Ukraine have or know or is available to them. And all Putin has to do, I reiterate, is say this is possible only because of the European.
Yep. It reminds me of a conversations I've had in the last week with some Iranian officials who tell me the same thing. He said, ever since the United States started hitting us, our people have become closer to us, even though prior to that, they were protesting us, and now they're coming out on the streets protesting on our behalf. So it's the same kind of mindset that we see over and over again. Morad, you're such a good guy. Thanks so much for joining us and sharing your perspective on this. Keep up the good work, my friend. All right, let's talk about Iran now, because the MOU is out, the Memorandum of Understanding. We have it. We have the details. We have the points. And I want to be able to take you through them, because Iran has essentially released what to their press, what they explain as the 14 points. And then the U.S. did the same thing. And I looked at both and said, they match. It's a match. All 14 points are exactly the same. In the past, they'd say left. The other ones would say right. You know, they'd say red. The other ones would say blue. This time, they match up quite nicely. So let's get started. Point one. Here we go. Let me read it to you. The United States of America and the Islamic Republic of Iran and their allies, right, in the current war are signing this MOU to declare an immediate and permanent termination of the military operations on all fronts, including in Lebanon. Remember, by the way, two things there that I want to point out. The United States started this war. So for the United States to sign a piece of paper that essentially says we're out, that's saying something. That's kind of a loss. That's kind of capitulation. But more importantly, look at the last part of that, what it just said about Lebanon. You notice they made sure that Lebanon was included. Immediate permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, including Lebanon. Remember, Israel is the one who involved Lebanon. This war was between the United States, Israel, and Iran. And then the Israelis got Lebanon involved because they said, well, that war's going on over there. We might as well go and attack Lebanon right now. That probably didn't sit well with Mr. Trump. In fact, Mr. Trump said last night that it didn't sit well with him. Take a listen.
Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long, and too many people are being killed. And you don't have to knock down an apartment house every time you're looking for somebody, because there are a lot of people in those apartment houses, and they're not all Hezbollah, that I can tell you. Without the United States, there would be no Israel. Without me, there would be no Israel, because no other president was willing to do what I did. I've had a great relationship with Bibi, but now Bibi has to be more responsible with respect to Lebanon. Now, I'm not happy with the way Israel has handled themselves with Lebanon and with Hezbollah.
I'm not happy with the way they're handling Lebanon and with Hezbollah. That's fascinating to hear him say that. I thought it was kind of fake before. It's real. He really is angry at what the Israelis are doing. Let's go to number two. You ready? This is the second point in the memorandum. The United States of America and the Islamic Republic of Iran undertake to respect each other's sovereignty and territorial integrity, and to refrain from interfering in each other's internal affairs. Think about this for a minute. It wasn't too long ago that we were calling them a rogue state, a horrible state, a country filled with nothing but terrorists, illegitimate state, a regime, etc. And now the language I just read to you pretty much legitimizes that government. It's legitimizing Iran, legitimizing the country that Israel wanted the world to absolutely hate. And now they're in cahoots with the United States of America. I mean, this smacks against things like what Huckabee said, for example. Take a listen.
It is your heritage, without a doubt. But, Minister, it is also the heritage of the United States. Without Israel, without the Jewish Foundation, there would not be an America. We owe our very existence to what happened in this land.
The United States owes its existence to Israel? What? How? Where? When? But this is the stuff that these guys are trying to put out there. And with this MOU, Mr. Trump is saying, nope, the opposite. If anything, we're going to be working with the Iranians now. Let's go to number three. The United States of America. The United States of America and the Islamic Republic of Iran commit to negotiating and achieving a final deal in 60 days, extendable with mutual consent. That pretty much explains itself. Let's go to number four. Number four, immediately upon the signing of the MOU, the United States of America will begin the removal of its naval blockade and any disturbances or impediments against the Islamic Republic of Iran and will fully end the naval blockade within 30 days. What does that say? It says the army that went in to defeat you has decided to leave. We're leaving the theater. We're pulling our ships out. We're pulling our military out. We're done. The war we were going to fight, we no longer want to fight it. I mean, that kind of speaks for itself, doesn't it? And it's really making a lot of people in the United States who are war hungry, the neocons, the people who make money off of wars, they're angry about this. And if you want to find them, just turn on your favorite cable news station. For example, here's Fox News last night.
This deal and everything that we know about it, to the degree that it is being spun in public by this, you know, and behind the scenes by the administration, everything about this deal seems bad to me. It all seems bad. It all seems like a setback. It doesn't seem like it meets any of the measures that the president actually put out there of his goals when it came to this conflict. And look, at some point, this Republican Party needs to decide which kind of foreign policy it's going to have. Is it going to be an America first foreign policy, one that is bold, that uses American power in key moments decisively in order to affect what it wants to achieve? Or are we going to just backslide into being some kind of Hillbilly Obama kind of GOP? That is not something that is acceptable to me. It should not be acceptable to Republicans, and it should not be acceptable to any conservative who is interested in the success of America going forward.
Two things. First of all, that guy knows absolutely nothing about the geopolitics of the region, knows nothing about the world. He's just reciting the same damn talking points that they go over and over again in places like Fox News and CNN, this America first stuff. America first means we have to go fight wars for other countries. That's America first. How in the hell is that America first? But there it is. And that's what the American people get night after night after night. And they're basically now turning on Donald Trump because he's not giving them what they want. I forgot what number we were on. I think number five, yes. After signing the MOU, number five, the Islamic Republic of Iran will make arrangements using its best efforts for the safe passage of commercial vessels with no charge for 60 days. Only 60 days. After that, they're going to come up with a deal. Iran, think about it. This is something they didn't do before, but they're going to do it now. They're going to get together with Oman to define the future administration and maritime services in the Strait of Hormuz in the discussion with other Persian Gulf countries. In other words, they're going to be eventually charging people to use the Strait of Hormuz. Think about this for a minute. Think about what this says. The Strait of Hormuz used to be run, used to be owned, used to be administered, used to be monitored, managed, really by the West, including the United States. This is saying no more. After 60 days, Oman and Iran, the two countries, Oman is over here, Iran is over here, to go through the Strait of Hormuz, we're going to manage it. We decide how much you pay to get through, et cetera. By the way, I looked it up. By international law, they're correct. They can do this. Let's go to number six. The United States of America undertakes with regional partners to develop a definitive, mutually agreed upon plan with at least $300 billion for the reconstruction and economic development of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Wow. Iran is going to get $300 billion to rebuild what the United States military destroyed. Now, to be fair, it's coming in the form of an investment fund. And it's not really coming from the United States, to be fair. Most of it's going to be coming from Persian Gulf states. But think about this. Persian Gulf states are now mandated to do business with Iran and do investments with Iran. That means you're creating a stronger coalition in that part of the world that didn't exist before. Iran used to be separated from those countries. Now, this deal is kind of bringing them together. It's almost ironic and yet probably good in some sense for the world. Let's go to number seven. The United States of America undertakes to terminate all sanctions on Iran against the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the Mac Daddy. I was in Iran. I talked to Iranian people, Iranian officials, Iranian mullahs, Iranian members of the government. This is their Mac Daddy. This is what they wanted all along. It was a suffering economy. The people were turning against the government because they had such problems. Getting rid of the sanctions will lift the economy of Iran like it never has been lifted before. Number eight. Let's go to number eight. The Islamic Republic of Iran reaffirms that it shall not procure or develop nuclear weapons. That was their position before the war started. Like, okay, we promise again to do what we had already promised to do before and had actually signed a contract with Obama and the JCPOA to affirm. Let's go to number 9. The Islamic Republic of Iran will maintain the current status quo of its nuclear program, and the United States of America will not impose any new sanctions and will not deploy additional forces. Essentially, what this says is, you always said you were attacking us because of the nuke program. Well, you can't do that anymore. You have to write on paper that you're not going to attack us and then say, oh, it's because of your nuke program. And that's essentially what that affirms. Let's go to number 10. The U.S. Department of Treasury will issue waivers for the export of Iranian crude oil. This is, talk about boosting the economy. From now on, they issue waivers so that Iran can no longer be stopped from exporting its petroleum, its crude, its products, its derivatives, all services, its banking transactions, its insurance programs, and its transportation. Iran is going to be able to buy and sell in the world of commerce just like everybody else, something they haven't been able to do for decades. Number 11, the United States of America undertakes to make fully available for the use frozen or restricted funds and assets of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Wow. Wow. From my reading, there's about $120 billion that have been frozen, right? $120 billion. It's Iran's money. And they just froze it. They said, you can't use your own money, which is fascinating. Because when you do that and it's in dollars, it sends a message to the world, then let's not trust the dollar. I'm not going to keep my money in dollars if I know that if I keep my money in dollars in a Western bank, somebody could come along one day and freeze it. So Trump last night recognized this and talked about this. He said, I got to give them their money back. And when they said, why are you giving them their money back? Because it's their money, and if we don't do this, no one will ever invest it, or nobody will ever trust the U.S. dollar. Here, listen to Trump.
We have taken a lot of their money, and we have their money. We have taken their money. It's not our money. It's their money, and we froze it. At a certain point in time, I guess we're going to have to give it back. You know, if we didn't give it back, nobody would ever invest in the dollar again. If you took their money, because I thought about it, you know, I'm not the most perfect person. I said to Scott, Scott, why do we keep their money? What the hell are we giving it back to them? But, you know, people from lots of nations, some nations we don't agree with, they have their money. The dollar's become very strong under me.
By the way, I don't know if you've noticed. Did you see Marco Rubio's face? He is not happy. He is not happy. He doesn't want to be there. He doesn't like what Trump has done. He's completely against this. Remember, Marco Rubio is very much a Zionist, 100%. And he feels like this is a bad deal, and he is just in total disagreement with the president. And if you get to see that video again, you'll see throughout the entire, I was watching, I couldn't take my eyes off him through the entire thing. He's like this, stern, lips tight, looking away, like, anyway. What number are we at, guys? 12? 12, thank you. Let's do 12. The United States of America and the Islamic Republic of Iran agree that an executive mechanism will be established to monitor the successful implementation of this MOU, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's pretty self-descriptive, right? Let's go to number 13. Number 13, after signing this MOU, the United States of America and the Islamic Republic of Iran will start negotiations regarding the final deal exclusively on the other paragraph. So that basically means that they're gonna hash out the sanctions and the nuclear stuff over the next 6 months or so. But they're going to sign it first. But they're going to work on those things even after signing it. And then finally, number 14, the final deal will be endorsed by a binding United Nations resolution, which basically says this thing is being affirmed. It's being signed in public. It's like a marriage in many ways. We come here amongst all you people to show that we are dedicated to this. And the Iranians and the Trump administration are going to do this. And it's amazing that we've come to this point. But I think it came to a point where Mr. Trump looked at the... He's not a stupid man. Mr. Trump looked at the field and said, I'm losing. I'm losing the war. I'm losing politically. My economy's going to hell. The American people are starting to hate me. It's not working for the press. The world is looking at me as a guy who started a war he couldn't win. I got to get out. I got to get out. Sorry, Bibi. And I think by reading this document for the first time, I just got my hands on it today, I think those are the signals. Those are the signs that I'm seeing there. Joining us now is Anthony Aguilar. He is a former Special Forces member, Green Beret. More importantly, for this story, he is the courageous U.S. envoy sent to Gaza to monitor the situation there. And what he did was so impressive. He came away horrified by what he saw, but rather than just leave, shut up, and not say anything about it, he said, no, I got to tell this story. So he told it. He told it to my friend Tucker. He told it to others who I know, and he's good enough to join us now. Thank you so much, sir, for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, first of all, catch people up on just the beginning of your story. What was the revelation for you when you were there based on what you saw and what you experienced?
Well, after 25 years of fighting in war as a Green Beret and fighting in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria, when I went into Gaza for the first time on the 24th of May, first what I witnessed, what I experienced was not war. It is an entire destruction of society, a genocide, the targeting of children, the targeting of unarmed civilians, the starvation, the suffering. And then beyond that, it became very apparent to me that the United States government was in part funding this operation, this GHF operation, which simply served to further displace the population. And as we continued on this operation, I had a confrontation with one of the senior members of this GHF effort when an Israeli officer was threatening to shoot children off of a dirt berm. And I was then pulled aside and told that, you know, we don't ever disagree with the client. We work for the IDF. And that was the point to where I realized that we're not here as an independent unilateral operation to provide aid and alleviate suffering. We are here quite literally operating as a military appendage or a parallel operation or a shaping operation to the Israeli military operations in Gaza. And the food is simply serving as a bait or a way to entice starving human beings to leave their homes, from which when they leave their homes to come and get this food at these distribution sites that were all placed in the south, they never get to go home, because then that's followed through with bombing or destruction of those neighborhoods. And then finally, the eventual, I guess, the final straw for me was, we were conducting planning for a handover operation to give one of the distribution sites to an IDF artillery unit, where they would be staged for operations into the north, into Gaza City. So I participated in a planning conference on how we would transition this location over, mm-hmm. while we're also in the midst of aid operations and active combat. And in doing so, I saw with my own eyes and witnessed this, this entire project laid out of the reconstruction of Gaza, and it's called Project Sunrise. Little did I know then, but as I've seen now, that it is actually part of the Board of Peace plan for this overall transition eventually to rebuild Gaza. And when I saw this, and I saw condominiums and luxury hotels and a Riviera, et cetera, that plan had been developed by the United States, by the Boston Consulting Group and others, by other Zionists, in 2021. So this is not 2023 October or beyond. This is 2 years before October of 2023. And so that was something that I looked at. I was like, this is all a plan. This is all premeditated. And the U.S. is involved. And I have to get out of here, and I have to tell members of Congress.
And you did. Is there any doubt in your mind that those people that you saw there were living under occupied conditions? Any doubt?
Zero doubt in my mind that the Palestinians are living under oppressive occupation.
And by occupation, we mean they don't control their own welfare, their own lives, their own decisions. It's being controlled for them.
Imagine a city in the United States of 2 million people where every drop of water, every morsel of food, every vial of medicine, every diaper, pamper, baby formula, vaccine, drop of gas has to come in from outside. And the outside source of which it comes in is completely controlled by the entity that also wants to destroy you. Yes, absolutely occupied and controlled without any modicum of a doubt.
The United Nations has said it's a genocide. Do you believe it's a genocide?
It is a genocide.
One of your stories that you tell, which I was struck by, almost brought tears to me, was when you said they used the food as bait, because that's how they would move people from one place to another. And oftentimes when the people would run to the food because they were starving or hungry or desperate, that's when they would shoot at them. That sounds horrific.
Yes, some have characterized this and likened it to the Hunger Games or to, the Squid Games, red light, green light. And it's actually, it's worse than that. Thousands of Palestinians who are coming to these sites to get food because it's the only option of where they can get any food under the total occupation control and the blocking of aid. And in doing so, they would be fired upon coming and going. Tank fire, artillery fire, machine gun fire, and the like. And not only that, the distribution sites were also intentionally placed and built in locations that would require Palestinians on foot over many miles to travel through the active combat operational areas of where the IDF were conducting operations. So through minefields, through where military units, Merkava tanks, infantry are operating to get to food. So not only are they contending with the very harsh conditions and the realities of having to move many miles on foot in a war zone, but also through active shooting conflict. It was a horrible situation.
What makes a person capable of doing, these types of things? Sometimes when I go jogging in the morning and I see a bug or a grasshopper, I get mad at myself if I accidentally step on it, and I avoid doing it because it's a living thing and I don't want to destroy it. The stories that you tell are of human beings killing other human beings as if they didn't have as much value as that bug that I'm trying to avoid. What is that? How does that happen? I know you're a soldier and you've been involved in warfare, but can you explain that to us?
Well, part of the strategy over time in the Israeli or the, what I would say in the Zionist narrative, is to dehumanize and remove all human value of Palestinians to where the world and certainly the IDF don't see them as human. And this is something that has been going on for decades in terms of the dehumanization process of this. And that's taken to an extreme in Israel, where you have members of the Israeli Knesset, like a Ben-Gavir or a Bezalel Smotrich or a Netanyahu, who openly refer to Palestinians as animals. They call occupation or military operations as mowing the lawn. They call cutting off aid or cutting off food at periodic times, and this is before October 7, 2023, as putting the Palestinians on a diet. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about children. We're talking about mothers trying to feed children. in my entire military career, and the combat that I have seen wasn't sitting at an office chair somewhere deployed in the desert. As a Green Beret, as an infantry officer fighting on the front lines of Raqqa, Baghdad, Fallujah, all throughout Afghanistan, when you see the level of suffering, for example, a mother pulling a wooden pallet with a piece of rope, and her children are dead, either died of starvation or from being shot or killed in this war, and she's begging for reprieve to at least bury her children. Because in Gaza, if you attempt to dig a hole, you will be targeted and killed. Hmm. So the absolute level of depravity and the erasure of humanity is something that I found to be very concerning in terms of, I saw it as something is that this doesn't end here in Gaza. This is not an endeavor where the people doing it just do it in Gaza and say, okay, we're done. This will expand to Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And this is something months ago. And where do we find ourselves now?
Yeah. By the way, just real quick thing, because you're describing what some of these IDF guys do and what you saw. Yet we hear from the Israelis that their IDF soldiers, et cetera, use much more restraint, are much more professional than American soldiers. I've heard them say that on a couple of occasions, and it's bothered me, even though I've never been an American soldier. I just happen to be an American. It must bother the hell out of you.
You know, throughout my career in the military, I was always told the same thing from our own military leaders, that the Israeli army is the best. They're great. We should learn from them. They're the best army in the world. Huh. And I believe that hype. I've trained with the Israeli military a few times, and in doing so, that hype or that mystique quickly became diluted to where I was like, they're not great. They fight very well as a non-expeditionary, stay-at-home defensive force with billions of dollars of military equipment and material that come from us, the United States taxpayer, when they're fighting against women and children and unarmed people. Mm. They do great. They're great at that. But we've seen from when they actually go on the ground into Gaza and have to face Hamas, or they're on the ground in Lebanon and they have to face Hezbollah, they do very bad on the ground fighting a capable asymmetric enemy. They are not the most moral army. They are not restrained. I witnessed the IDF in machine gun positions or fighting positions or with their Merkava tanks openly firing into crowds of thousands. And I'll tell you, when I was in Gaza on distribution site number one on the 26th of May, 2025, our first day of distribution, we were told everything from the Palestinians want to kill you, they're going to kidnap you, they're going to this, you know, you name it, the big bad wolf, the boogeyman. And on that first day of distribution, the IDF could not hold back the crowd of over 34,000 people. And when they rushed to the site to get whatever was left of scraps of food, myself and the other contractors were in the middle of it. If they had intent to kill us or to harm us or to kidnap us, it would have happened. The ratio would have been 1 to 1,020 based on U.S. contractor to Palestinian. And not one of those Palestinians that came to this site looking for food was armed, not a stick, not a rock, not a rifle, any type of weapon, no hostile intent, no anger. In fact, we were greeted with begging for joy and mercy and, you know, kissing us on the cheeks and thanking us for being there to help. Not one instance in the entire time that I was there in the 46 days on the ground in Gaza did I ever witness hostile intent from any Palestinian at all. Certainly never anything that would raise to the level of a threat to where the IDF or anyone should be opening fire on unarmed women and children.
Given how the Israelis have tried to expand this war in Iran into Lebanon, something which you describe akin to what they did in many ways in Gaza. Do you agree with me when I said a moment ago, I don't know if you heard this in my intro, that Mr. Trump is kicking himself for allowing Bibi Netanyahu and the Israelis to talk him into this seeming fiasco that we have seen in Iran? Do you agree?
I was watching that segment, Rick, and I can tell you, as you said it, my nod of affirmation, I agree with you completely.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that the... Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, I think that at this point, Donald Trump is really... if you just look at his body language, you look at the people around him, like a Marco Rubio, et cetera, the Zionists are upset that he isn't doing more for the Zionist state. And he looks like a man in regret. He looks like a man who regrets his decisions. And I think that he realizes Donald Trump is not a dumb man. He realizes that this 14-point deal that we just signed going into this agreement is an absolute win for Iran in every aspect. And the truth is, had we not started this war, the position that we had with Iran in terms of however tenuous it may have been would still be a much better position than we are now, considering it from an American perspective on what Iran has won from this conflict. I mean, that 14-point document to me, if you were to read it, imagine years from now when children are doing history reports on the great Iran-U.S. war. Yeah. You would read that to a child and you'd be like, wow, that's the U.S. lost that.
Yeah, we often try to tell a different story, but it is what it is in many ways. Finally, let me ask you what a lot of people are wondering and also worried about, and that is that the Israelis, the Netanyahu government in particular, which needs to try and stay in power, will now possibly do everything they can to sabotage this deal and probably consider doing something like bombing Beirut once again, which they know will cause Iran to hit them, which could, you know, create a big snafu there once again. Do you think that could happen?
I absolutely do think that it could happen. I think that it's very likely. And I think that Israel is already looking at plans. In fact, we during the signing of this agreement, we've heard from Israel Katz, we've heard from the Ben-Gavirs and the Smotriches and the other hawkish warmongering of the Israeli cabinet who have said, we're not going to honor this. We will continue the fight in Lebanon as we see fit. So I think that we're going to see Israel continue the ground operations in the south, continue air bombardment or air strikes in particular locations south of Beirut, or maybe even in Beirut to send a message. Because remember, even just 2 weeks ago, Israel's fight is not just against Hezbollah. They assassinated one of the senior leaders, the field general of the southern forces of the Lebanese army,
mm-hmm.
government of Lebanon, not Hezbollah, no. Not a terrorist organization. The one of a senior military and his staff of the government of Lebanon. So do I see that Israel is highly likely that they're going to do something that would then greatly put this agreement in peril of derailing? I absolutely do see that as a reality.
Wow. You are an absolute credit to the U.S. military. You're a good American. We need more of you. We need more people who can see things for what they are and tell the story for what it is, which is what you have done. Your experience, your story of awakening, which is really what it was, is magnificent. And you've been very true to it. And I respect you for that. Thank you so much. You're a good American for coming on our show and sharing this.
A lot, and truly appreciate it, and honored to be able to have a discussion with you today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We certainly appreciate it. And that's it for us. Wow.
Sure.
What a story, huh? That's it for us. But, you know, given what's going on in the world right now, for myself, you know, you noticed his last name is Aguilar. My last name is Sanchez. It's not like I didn't think about that. You know, Americans come from all parts of the world. but it doesn't matter where they come from. It doesn't matter their skin color. It doesn't matter their language that they use and the countries that they may have come from. What matters is what kind of morals they have, what kind of ethics. My dad used to always talk to me about principles, right? Without principles, you're nothing. This is a story of a man with principles. They sent him there. It's a good gig. He's probably making over $200,000 a year working for this group that was supposed to go there representing the United States of America to make sure that they were checking on the Palestinians. And instead, he said, no, this is wrong. What my eyes are telling me is wrong, and I will not support this, and I will fight against it. And that's what he's done since. That's courage. That's true courage. That's valor. And I respect it. You can find us on X. You can find us on Spotify. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on BitChute. Feel free to leave your thoughts. All feedback is appreciated, even when it's negative. Thanks so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.